Good evening and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for March 19th, 2026. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. Today we return to the issue of election integrity regarding the upcoming midterm elections in November and the primary elections that began just weeks ago. With us to discuss some of the issues that call into question the undermining of this year's elections is independent journalist Justin Glaw. Justin began his career in journalism in 2010 at his hometown newspaper, the Peoria Journal-Star. And yes, that's the real Peoria, as in Illinois. And thereafter, with the Bemidji Pioneer in northern Minnesota, he set out to freelance. He was in Ferguson for weeks following the death of Michael Brown and continued writing about police shootings across the country for the next 2 years before switching to national news events for the Daily Beast, Vice, Esquire, and other magazines. In 2014, he moved to Chicago and covered violence and police shootings, then to Texas in 2016, where he covered immigration and the border extensively, often reporting from Juarez and El Paso. So as you can see, this guy gets around the country. His home now is in Savannah, Georgia, where he continues to report on immigration and has also reported extensively on the election denial movement, efforts to interfere in U.S. elections. His most recent work on these topics has been carried in Rolling Stone, Zadio, and The Guardian. So let's discuss the prospects for undermining the midterm elections. Justin Glaw, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we're really lucky to have you. The head of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, was questioned in a House hearing yesterday about international threats faced by the U.S. and we're in the middle of this war. But she also made the news 2 months ago when she assisted in an FBI raid on the elections office in Georgia, where you're based, and that would be Fulton County Election Office, which, of course, is Atlanta, which has a huge black population, Democratic Party population. Ballots from the 2020 presidential election were taken. That's the election that Trump lost. In the current atmosphere of questioning the validity of elections, this feels very ominous. And as an independent journalist, Justin, you've been very busy trying to get to the bottom of this through the Freedom of Information Act requests and lawsuits. What the heck is going on?
Well, wouldn't we all like to know? Essentially, what's going on is the election denial movement is not only alive and well, but it has many very willing partners within the Trump administration and the federal government. So what led to the raid at the elections warehouse in Fulton County was a Justice Department application for a search warrant that a magistrate judge here signed off on. And the affidavit that made up the government argument for probable cause was root and branch election denial movement forces and personalities behind it, including Kurt Olson, who was involved in Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election, but also a handful of the small but very vocal and very influential network of election deniers here in Georgia. In regards to Tulsi Gabbard, it's, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned her because, you know, I've been fighting in Georgia courts to get more information about this affidavit. And one of the things that not just my lawyers have noted, but that Fulton County has noted is that there is no mention of foreign interference or foreign government interference in that affidavit, which raises even more questions about the presence of Tulsi Gabbard at, you know, the raid in late January, because Director of National Intelligence, her purview typically entails foreign threats, which is why, you know, her presence there was so eyebrow raising. But that's essentially what's going on. The election denial movement is very alive and very well and has a lot of willing partners within the Trump administration.
So I guess this was legal because they had the permission from the courts, but it is pretty bizarre, like you said. But what possible purpose? Is this like all a big drama to cast doubt on the elections, or is there more are they being able to get the ballots this way? And that's something that they want to have. They want to have the state's ballots.
Look, I think that the Trump administration and the true believers within the Justice Department and the election denial movement would say this is about righting the wrong of 2020. They truly believe that the election was stolen from Trump in 2020, and they are trying to prove that still. But in practical reality, I guess, they're never going to prove that because it can't be proven. It's already been disproven.
In the courts.
In reality. Many, many times.
Yeah.
Multiple audits in Georgia, multiple recounts in Georgia, audits in Arizona, Trump having 30-some-odd lawsuits thrown out of court over and over and over again, no proof or disproven, right? So for all practical purposes, what they are doing with this is exactly what, you know, you just said. It's just essentially sowing further distrust and doubt in future election results by grabbing all these ballots, grabbing these materials, and then, you know, going through them and at some point holding a press conference or releasing a report that says, well, we found it, or, you know, whatever it is that they're going to say.
That's what I expect.
And yeah, that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, another fun fact is during this raid, she was on the phone with President Trump, right? So he was involved in the investigation of the case of the election that he himself lost. That's quite irregular, isn't it?
It is highly irregular. And one other thing, this entire raid is highly irregular. And by highly irregular, I cannot stress this point enough, and I feel like it's been a little bit lost in the deluge of news, and whether it's election news or other news, whatever. But to my knowledge, and to a lot of other people who have been in the election world for a lot longer than I have, this is the only time in American history that I'm aware of where the federal government has come in and seized election records and materials from a state and local government. Like, this has never happened before. I don't know of any other time that this has occurred in an American history. So it's the definition of unprecedented. You know, this is not just, oh, we broke some norms here. Like, this has never happened before.
So does anybody know where the ballots are now?
Great question, and that's one of the questions that Fulton County has been asking in all of the back and forth court filings that have been ongoing since the raid on January 28th. Fulton County is essentially fighting to get the ballots back. And in the process of this back and forth, this has been reported on locally, but, you know, again, with everything that's going on, folks might not be fully aware of all this. But the back and forth in these filings in this case have been incredible to read, because Trump's Justice Department has been making extraordinary claims of power. They have essentially said that Fulton County has, I'm not kidding here, that they have no Fourth Amendment rights in regards to the seizure of these ballots. And mind you, these ballots and the other materials that were seized were already the subject of ongoing litigation between the government, the Justice Department, Fulton County. The government was set to get copies of these materials. They just didn't want the copies. They didn't want to wait. They wanted the actual things. And now they are saying in these court filings that have happened subsequently after the raid, we can hold on to these whenever we want. In fact, the Justice Department says, well, we'll consider giving these records and these materials and these ballots back to Fulton County at some point in time. So it really is quite extraordinary, the legal arguments and the legal powers that the Justice Department is asserting in this case.
So in most cases, there would be a chain of custody issue, but here, since the election was already counted and over, are we still worried about that?
Certainly, that is one of the things that Fulton County has said that they are worried about. In addition to, you know, the point about the election being well over at this point is not also lost on Fulton County, because, you know, essentially the statute of limitations for any sort of criminal wrongdoing, if it were to exist, is long gone at this point, you know. So the big questions about why even seize these materials still remain very pertinent, especially considering that statute of limitations.
Well, she did something, too. Gabbard was also involved in a raid on the Puerto Rican Office of Elections based in Florida. She's having a lot of fun, isn't she? So is that sort of the same thing? I guess that was to try to bring in the foreign influence because they speak Spanish there, and so do they speak Spanish in Venezuela. Is that so? What was that raid about?
The only thing I can say is that the election denial movement has been laser focused on voting machines for years. And essentially, they would like to see a complete prohibition on voting machines. And you might remember back in 2020, there was a draft executive order that was circulating at the White House that was brought up by Sidney Powell and former Army General Mike Flynn and some others. That called for the military to seize voting machines, and Trump never signed that order. It's not really clear how close it got to his desk. But this stuff about voting machines, is really at the heart of the election denial movement and the policies that they're proposing. And in fact, if you remember from early in this Trump administration, he issued an executive order that essentially banning voting machines. I'm glad you reminded me of the Puerto Rico thing. I'd forgotten about it, but that's kind of what's at the heart of that.
There is apparently someone at DHS who has once also banned voting machines, and this was in a news item just on March 14th, less than a week ago. This guy is David Horvitz. Is that pronunciation may be correct? Looks like a Czechoslovakian ending on there with a CZ. But he co-founded a firm in 2020 with another election denier, and now they are relitigating the president's bail about the election. And this company founded was with James Penrose, if that rings a bell. And they helped launch these conspiracy theories. And these people are trying to ban voting machines now, working in the federal branch, is my understanding.
Not surprising at all. Like I said, I mean, this has been sort of like one of the key planks of the election denial movement since 2020. It doesn't surprise me at all. For a while now, it's been pretty obvious that after Trump got elected this time around, there's now a governmental arm of the election denial movement, right? Mm-hmm. It is no longer these people sort of working on the outside. I mean, they are in the inside, you know. Also at DHS, you have Heather Honey, who's a well election denier here. So they're populating lots of federal agencies and in pretty substantial positions of power to try to implement these policies and pursue this sort of broader belief system.
Mm-hmm. Would you say this core of election deniers are also sprinkled throughout the state election offices at this point?
You know, that's a great question. Certainly in Georgia, the state election board is dominated by a majority of election denial, election activist type folks that are very pro-Trump and very, very much in that world, right? But your average, secretary of state's office in other states, I haven't really seen that much evidence of that. One of the things that I focused on back in 2023, well, really starting after 2020 and then leading up into 2024, was I looked at a lot of local election offices. You know, in Georgia and a lot of other places, there's county boards of elections, right? And you guys know what they do. I mean, they help determine where our polling places are and, you know, some of the nitty gritty, just kind of like logistical stuff that is required for us to go and vote. Anyway, I looked at hundreds of these election offices and thousands of individual board members and to, you know, sort of vet them for their, you know, possible ties to, election denial type stuff. And towards the end of 2024, I came up with about 300, some odd people who had professed some sort of belief in election denial stuff in, the 8 swing states. So in my mind, it's more at that level and less at the state level.
Mm-hmm. Great.
I want to mention from another article that the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University they've mentioned that there are about a dozen states who have given their voter data, unredacted voter data, I should say, to the federal government to allegedly look for non-citizens. And that's Alaska, Arkansas, Indiana, Kansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Nebraska, Ohio, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, and Wyoming. I don't see any swing states there, but that's, you know, that looks like, I'm assuming that the state governments are red Republican, and so they're easy to liable to pass over the information. The other states that are resisting, I don't have a list of them, but there are several also that are still in court over that issue.
Dozens. And in fact, here in Georgia, you know, the Secretary of State has resisted this as well, while meanwhile, you know, the Republican-led state legislature has either introduced some sort of law or something that says, hey, we should give our voter data over to the federal government just along the lines of the states that you just mentioned. So it's quite the battle that's been going on for some time now over these voter lists, you know, is effectively what they are.
So I wonder, there's so many problems to deal with right now. Can we move on to our next problem? Steve, did you have something else on the election denier officialdom?
Let's see. Well, we already covered the voter rolls. And so that's still in the courts and will be some time. Although, meanwhile, primaries are already underway. The March primaries, I think there's a breather in April, and then there's a few more, certainly in June, I think some in May. And they go all the way through August and even September, I believe. So there's numerous states that...
Which brings up another fun fact, which is the SAVE Act. So Trump is busy orchestrating a war in Iran and running Venezuela as a co-president of Venezuela and wants to take Cuba. But the thing that he's most interested in is the SAVE Act. He spends more time promoting the SAVE Act than he does all these foreign countries that we have belligerencies with. Do you want to talk about what the SAVE Act is about?
Yeah, sure. I'm certainly no expert on this, but the things off the top of my head that stand out about the SAVE Act is that the way that Republicans have been describing it is largely, I would say, disingenuous. You know, they are calling it a voter ID bill, and they are framing it as, you know, the argument and the analogy that has been used a lot in these last few weeks is, well, you have to show your ID to buy a six-pack of beer. Why don't you have to show your ID to vote? Well, in fact, you do have to show your ID to vote in just about every state that I can think of. That is not what the SAVE Act does. The SAVE Act, from my understanding of it, creates a lot of additional restrictions on how you can register to vote. It is not about making it so that people can't go into a polling location without an ID of any kind and just go ahead and vote for, you know, whoever they want to. You know, the SAVE Act is, again, based in a belief in widespread election. You know, the election denial movement has really just metastasized wildly since 2020. I mean, it started out with, you know, as we all may remember, it really started out with mail-in and absentee ballots, and it was focused on Pennsylvania. And we all knew this was coming. We knew that because of COVID and because of the additional surge in mail-in and absentee ballots from voters who did not want to expose themselves to the coronavirus, we knew that there was going to be that surge of those ballots. And so we knew that Republicans were going to tend to vote more in person. And then when the absentee and mail-in ballots came in, we knew, based on historical election data, that those were going to tend to be more Democratic-leaning. And so everyone knew this. It was common knowledge. And then, of course, when it happened, that's when Trump began calling fraud. Oh, well, now the numbers are changing, and I was leading in Pennsylvania, and now I'm losing. So the election denial movement started with that. Then it went to voting machines. And now, you know, back in 2024 and currently, we've now moved on to non-citizen voting. And that's what's at the heart of the SAVE Act,
is an unfounded belief in widespread voting by undocumented immigrants, essentially. And that's just not something that even remotely happens on, you know, any sort of level that would even have an effect on really any election, right? That's why they are pushing the SAVE Act. And again, how much of it is they actually want to pass it and how much of it is that they just want to sow distrust in an election that polls show that they are not faring very well in potentially, who's to say? But when we bring up the SAVE Act, that's kind of what I think of.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners, we're speaking with an independent journalist, Justin Glaw, about the prospects for undermining the midterm elections, and we'll take calls as usual starting at the bottom of the hour in a few minutes.
Yeah, it's really a scary thing, the SAVE Act. But I think that two things about it. One is that it probably is not going to go anywhere past the House, but it can't overcome a filibuster in the Senate. So I would think that we were home free on that, and it's a massive problem if it did pass, because it would, over 20 million people would be disenfranchised by the restrictions. But on the other hand, the rhetoric is so inflamed. I mean, the president is saying is that he won't sign anything until he gets the SAVE Act passed. And then there's some of the right-wing news outlets are urging people that if the SAVE Act isn't passed and you need to arm yourself. I mean, it's nuts.
Well, and, you know, here's something to think about, which is something that I've been kind of considering lately, as there's similar sort of legislative kind of maneuverings going on in Georgia regarding some stuff that's related to, you know, the November elections. But, you know, how much do Republicans actually want to pass the SAVE Act compared to how much do they want to try to pass the SAVE Act and have Democrats in the House shoot it down so that they can then say, we tried to safeguard the November elections, but Democrats wouldn't allow it to happen. And so therefore, probably all this cheating happened, and it's because of the Democrats. You know, which one is it? Again, who's to say? But, you know, that's something that I've been thinking about lately is there is a political win to be had for Republicans. There potentially is a political win if Democrats, you know, kill the SAVE Act.
And the Democrats are on a roll. They seem to be winning in all the contests that are going on right now, right? So it's a lot at stake.
Except for a few at the state level. But let's clarify for listeners then. The SAVE Act voting was intended to happen this week. We're 4 work days through the week. We looked for and didn't see any news about today. If there was, what happened today, if anything, regarding the SAVE Act, but it is very close. We had a program on this a year ago when it was first introduced. I think it was April last year. And so there's further details people can get looking online at for that particular program from a year ago. But it is currently in the Senate, suffering from the threat of a filibuster. I don't know if that's actually happened per se, but it is expected. And there are even a few Republicans, senators, who are opposing it. I know Ms. Murkowski up in Alaska, I believe, is one of them. So it's looking tough to get through. So I want to clarify that for voters. There could be news about it tomorrow or Monday, but it is that active literally today. For listeners that don't know that. One other question I have for you goes back to showing your papers that someone that claimed, and you've heard the claim, that well, people have to show an ID to buy alcohol. Have any of these people that you're aware of said that they think people should also produce a birth certificate and citizenship papers to buy alcohol?
Well, your point is well taken, uh-huh. Because that's funny. I mean, for some reason I had to do something with a birth certificate years ago, and I can't really remember what it was. And I just remember that I had my actual physical birth certificate, the original that was from the day I was born that the doctor gave to my parents.
Oh, my.
And I took it to the DMV to do something, and they were like, no, we actually need a certified copy. And I'm like,
what?
This is the one from 40 years ago that was from the hospital. I don't know how much more certified you can get, but I mean, if that's any indication of kind of the pitfalls of having to have this additional documentation, you know, and of course, you know, one of the strangest things about the SAVE Act to me is the number of Republican voters that it could potentially affect. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the documents that you would need to have here is a passport. You know, something like 50% of Americans do not have a passport. And I'm pretty sure if you look at those percentages in predominantly Republican states, that number is probably higher. You know, so that's something that's sort of I've never really heard. You know, a good sort of explanation from that, from Republicans as to, and apparently that there's real, you know, much in the way of concerns about that, you know, from right-wing media outlets or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the women feel particularly targeted because we often change our names in our adulthood, and then we wouldn't have a matching birth certificate with our current driver's license.
Mm-hmm. And don't forget about transgendered people, who are often changing their names and their sex, right? I don't think we can discount how much of a motivating factor that is in a piece of legislation like this, because we know how much Republicans, for instance, in the Trump administration have made it more difficult for transgendered individuals to change their sex markers on passports and things like that, right? So I don't think that that is not a part of this. I think that that is also, you know, part of the motivation here.
Yeah.
Yes, for sure. That's a target.
Let me also mention a few numbers, because there has been studies of the number of illegal voters, non-citizens voting, you know, and it is found to be a handful, literally, you know, a handful or a few handfuls. It's like a dozen or two out of many tens of millions of votes cast over the last few decades. So that is just 0.000, you know, something percent, as opposed to the people that stand to be disenfranchised is something like 21 million out of the current population of whatever it is. It's a little, you know, 120, 130 million, something like that. And so the scale is just completely, you know, off that to make any sense to do this. And I wanted to mention the an old saying, which we've all heard, how perfection is the enemy of the good. We have a system that works fine, and it is not perfect if you count that this teeny percentage of illegal votes from non-citizens. But the other alternative is worse by a factor of many thousands of percent. So that's what the numbers tell us, and that's what the fight is about in the Senate.
Well, so it does sort of look like the SAVE Act is stalled out, but there are states that are independently coming up with their own versions of the SAVE Act. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. And not just the SAVE Act, but again, going back to that executive order from early in Trump, if these things don't get done by a Republican-led Congress in D.C. or the Trump administration, you know, Republican-led states can always pick up the ball and go with it from there. And look, I mean, that is one of the battles that's ongoing in Georgia right now, where we face a deadline of July 1st to have a replacement ballot system that does not utilize QR codes. I will not get in the weeds here on QR codes, I promise you. It's very boring. But the bottom line is that the election denial movement forced this basic change to happen. The legislature set this deadline so that they would have to come up with a replacement system, and we do not yet have that replacement system. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the ways that, like, states can pick up the ball where the federal government and Congress may not be able to actually achieve some of the policy goals of the election denial movement.
Mm-hmm. Let me mention again, we're speaking with independent journalist Justin Glaw. And the topic for today is the prospects for undermining the midterm elections. And anyone that would like to get a question or comment into the program, please give us a call here at 707-895-2448.
So we've been talking about all the horrors that are going on, especially in Georgia right now, but there's also some really dynamite organizing going on in Georgia. There's the centerforcommonground.org, and they spend a lot of time organizing people of color and defending voting rights for people of color, making sure that the pathways of information are open. So you can check them, centerforcommonground.org, and CforJustice.com with Ray McClendon, another black organizing group. So those are two. And then, of course, you can tune into American.Gloom and check out what our guest Justin is doing to try to keep things honest in Georgia and everywhere else. So another thing that's going on that's kind of crazy is that there's an ongoing attacks from the Supreme Court on the Voting Rights Act, which used to be a bipartisan effort. It's been around for decades, and now the Supreme Court seems to be chipping away at that. Do you have any observations about that?
Again, a little bit outside of my purview, but you know, when I think of the Voting Rights Act, there has been some moves here in Georgia by our current Attorney General to essentially do away with the private right of action that the Voting Rights Act provides. So if you feel that you've been disenfranchised and somehow prevented from registering to vote, my understanding of it is that you can sue, right? You can get a civil rights lawyer and, you know, sue your county or sue your state. And Chris Carr, the current attorney general, who's one of 14 Republicans running for governor of the state of Georgia, has in recent years been one of, I think, several attorneys general, all Republicans, I think, who have tried to do away with that sort of protective measure of the Voting Rights Act. Because it's something about like the reason that that exists is because, you know, there's fewer recourses or something like that. If you feel like you've been disenfranchised. So, all of these things all go back to the simple and obvious fact that Donald Trump just could not accept the fact that he lost 2020. We were not having any of these conversations in 2018.
Right.
You know, we were not having any of these conversations in 2016. Although I will briefly remind folks, and it's been lost to history a little bit, but after, you know, Trump won in 2016, you know, he said that he actually thought he won bigger than he did, and that Hillary Clinton had like illegally gotten votes somehow, right? You know, so this whole thing with him has been going on for some time, but, you know, whether it's the Supreme Court and the Voting Rights Act or, you know, stuff in Georgia or wherever it is, all of these things, this is all because one guy just refused to accept a loss, and all these people have just gone along with it. We were not talking about any of this stuff before that.
I have to comment that there's a lot of people going along with it, like the Chief Justice at the Supreme Court. I mean, we're waiting for another ruling to come down on the Louisiana versus Calais case, which would make it hard for people of color to get representation in voting districts. So it's pretty crazy. Do you want to talk about some of the other things going on during the election, that the upcoming elections around the different states?
Sure, yeah. You know, one of the things that I think that I am looking out for is trying to figure out what the next possible move is by the Trump administration and by the Justice Department and or, you know, DHS or other federal agencies. And essentially, I think that probably looks something like what happened in Fulton County in late January. And so it prompts this really big and, you know, sort of unprecedented kind of question, which is, can the federal government seize materials from an ongoing election? And this seems to be, you know, some folks that I've talked to that are you know, pretty high-ranking election officials and experts and things like that seem to think that that's just really implausible. But there were probably a lot of people who prior to January 6, 2021, thought it was implausible that 100 and however many members of Congress would vote not to certify the results of an election, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it sort of reminds me of where we were back in 2024 when, you know, I had found instances of all of these local election officials who were election deniers. And some of them have refused to certify results. And a lot of the people that I was talking to that were election experts, I was sort of asking them, like, about all these hypothetical scenarios. Like, okay, what happens if this county refuses to certify and then the state can't certify and then, you know. And they were like, well, it'll never happen because it's a, you know, it's a ministerial duty and all of these things. And that's kind of that what we're potentially looking at now with future iterations of what happened in Fulton County potentially occurring in November kind of reminds me of that, all of those, you know, unanswered and new ground areas of the certification debate stuff back in 2024. You know, we're in uncharted territory here thinking about what will happen if, for instance, the Justice Department files an affidavit saying, you know, Wayne County, Michigan has a bunch of fraud. Look at all these things that people have been posting on Twitter. And therefore, here's our affidavit. We would like a search warrant. We would like to go seize these materials. And a judge says, okay, sure. And now we have FBI agents grabbing ballots from an ongoing election as it's being counted, right? Like, that seems crazy to think of, but the people that I've been talking to are saying, look, nothing's out of the realm of possibility. It may be implausible, but it's not impossible, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are dealing with desperation right now because the polls all show the Democrats are leading in the midterm. So we can expect all kinds of craziness. Wired magazine just published something saying that that the government is buying up offices all over the country for ICE offices, and they're close to the bigger cities. And that, of course, that's happening right now when we're coming into the midterms. And people are also worried about ICE turning up at the polling places to repress the vote. Do you have any nightmares about that?
You know, certainly I don't think that the non-answers from DHS officials in congressional hearings have put people at ease that, that they potentially won't send ICE to a polling location. And I think it's possible. I think that probably more within the realm of possibility, though, is exactly what we've always seen, right, which is some person says something about fraud and it gets amplified and it ends up on Donald Trump's Truth Social account. And the next thing you know is we're talking about something insane like Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, eating people's pets, right? Like that is how this information ecosystem works, right? And it works like that, whether it's fear mongering about immigrants or whether it's fear mongering about election fraud. And then from there, of course, you have the potential scenarios like what I just described, and certainly all of the other regular scenarios of things that happen in a contested election, you know, the lawsuits, the recounts, the audits, the delays when it comes to tabulating the votes, you know. And then we've got congressional certification matters that we also have to deal with in November, too. So, you know, there's all sorts of ways other than ICE masked police guys at polling locations that are, you know, potentially going to cause like a lot of chaos and a lot of problems in November.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners, the way to make a comment or ask a question is to call in here at 895-2448. That's, of course, in area code 707. And let me mention one article I did bring with me. It's and the headline is, this is from 2 weeks ago, on the 5th of March. Blue states push to ban ICE at polls amid federal voter intimidation fears. And that's an outfit called Stateline. That is, they cover the news at the state level on these issues. So they don't deal with the feds per se, but what are states doing about things? It subheading here is that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security says it has no plans to target voting locations. Well, would that be the case? I hope.
Okay, yeah, we hope. Yeah, it's such a crazy time right now. We're really grateful to have journalists such as you, Justin, who just take deep dives into things that most of us couldn't do, you know, with legal sorting through thousands, interviewing thousands of people and stuff. Oh, we have a call. Let's take that first.
Okay. Hello, caller, you're live on the air. What's your first name and from where are you calling?
My first name is David.
Hello, David.
Hey, my question for the guest is, if in fact the Democrats, enough Democrats win in November to flip the House and or the Senate, but the House is maybe more likely, is there any talk about, you know, how the House refused to allow a congressman, a Democratic congressman, from being seated for weeks and months? Is there any thought that the Republican Speaker of the House will just not allow Democratic elected Democrats to take their place in the Congress?
That's a great question, and that is something that I'm looking into, and that I know that a lot of other people are looking into, and not just reporters, but bipartisan, nonpartisan, you know, sort of pro-democracy groups that I've been in touch with are looking into the potential scenarios. You know, I call those broadly like sort of certification scenarios, but essentially what this entails is contested elections, and specifically the Federal Contested Elections Act. So you're right to point out that, you know, there is a process, right? But it gets a little bit sticky because, you know, the Senate is a continuing body, but the House is not. So we're electing an entirely new House, right? So Mike Johnson will not technically be, you know, Speaker of the House, like, you know, how we had it. I can't remember, honestly. This stuff can be very confusing. But the bottom line is, like, you are right to point out that there is a potential danger there of, you know, Republican members of Congress trying to object or to contest to Democrats who have won seats in either the House or the Senate, and holding up the appointment of those members.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know what we could do about it, but
bone up on the Federal Contested Elections Act is what I've been trying to do. That's about all I can say.
Thank you, David. I forgot to worry about that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Thanks. Bye. That reminds me, speaking of whether they could stonewall one or more new members of the House, reminds me of another incident in Georgia. Now, this is one when you were relatively new to the state, perhaps. Stacey Abrams and her outfit had registered, I don't know how many tens of thousands of new voters, and this might go back to 2016, I'm not sure exactly when. I think she was running for governor at the time, if I'm not mistaken. But
yes.
But the state just stonewalled those tens of thousands. They just didn't register. They just didn't. So they never didn't make it to the voter rolls and didn't vote in that election.
And let me tell you, by the way, election denial folks here love to point out the fact that Stacey Abrams contested the results of that election. You know, they love to say, hey, by the way, Democrats did it too, you know, which is an apples to oranges comparison. But yep.
Okay, well, let's take a next call here. Hello, caller, you're live on the air. What's your first name and from where are you calling?
From Ukiah.
And go ahead.
And I just wanted to cite the Brennan Center's 2007 report on voter fraud, and they're saying that the incident rate of fraud is 0.000. That's three zeros, three. So if we're trying to solve a problem that has an incident rate that low, which is also going to disenfranchise millions of people, so that's probably going to be a whole number in percentage. You know, it's just crazy. But, you know, we're not really trying to solve a problem anyway. We're just trying to sow chaos with this SAVE Act. And, you know, it's basically engineered to inject chaos into election administration. Plus, it's going to be a completely unfunded burden. Our own county Department of Elections, Katrina Bartlamay's position, you know, it would cost, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars to try to implement this in our little county that's already bankrupt. So it's an impossible task, and purposely so. And I think it might have been mentioned by your guest, but any election official who makes a mistake, you know, could face prison time for failing to collect all the right paperwork at the right time, even if it turned out that that citizen was an American citizen, but the documents weren't quite right. And anybody can bring those allegations against an election official. It doesn't have to be the DOJ or the district attorney. You know, anybody could face those kinds of allegations, if you will. So, you know, this is a bad, bad piece of legislation, as, you know, your guest is testifying to. And, you know, the Brennan Center is a great place for information in case people want to look into this. You know, they don't believe any of us, but they could look at the Brennan Center. And then also the League of Women Voters has been on this from the very beginning. And they're a great organization for information. So, you know, you can just type in League of Women Voters on your computer and you'll get to probably to the national, but there's a state and then there's also Mendocino County League of Women Voters. So this would probably be information coming out of the national because it's a federal deal. You know, one of the other ugly things I think about this legislation is it would require voter roll purges. You know, the federal government wants the voter rolls, right? And even if they don't get them, this legislation would require that the states run their voter rolls through the funny, it has the same name, a SAVE system. And of course, that's been demonstrated to be fraudulent, not fraudulent, but to produce fraudulent results. You know, it's not a perfect database by any means. So should our county be forced to run the voter rolls through that lousy database, obviously a lot of people would be kicked off the voter rolls, you know, probably with a Hispanic surname, you know, but it's not a good deal. This SAVE Act is definitely not a good deal. And kudos to you two and your guests for bringing this to the public's attention.
And thank you for calling, especially the information about the Brennan Center. It's really important that we do positive things like supporting the groups that do give us real information, ACLU, Public Citizen, the Brennan Center, Democracy Docket, State Line, and the Mendocino Coast League of Women Voters, all sources of information, and they need your support. And you can get a lot of information from America-Doom.com, where you can find the research that our guest Justin is doing, and that's also really important. Also, there's a big National No Kings Day coming up March 28th, 1 to 3 in front of the Ukiah Courthouse, and regular protests in Willits, Ukiah, and Fort Bragg, and Boonville going on every week.
That's right. Saturdays at 1 o'clock in front of the courthouse. That's in Ukiah and Willits. It's Fridays from 4 to 6 at Babcock Park right there on Main Street. over on the Fort Bragg on the coast. It's Saturdays at 11 a.m. at 343 North Main Street. And in Boonville on Fridays from 4:30 to 5:30.
The No Kings thing in Fort Bragg is going to be at the bridge.
All right, cool.
So on the 28th.
28th at the bridge in Fort Bragg.
Both sides, they say, and I bet they'll do it, too.
They will. I've seen them do that before. Cool. Thank you so much. We just have a few minutes left, Justin. Hey, we need to let you end this for us. What should we go away with here?
The caller made some great points here. I mean, look, number one, you know, the system that they are saying should be used to help clean voter lists of ineligible voters has a huge error rate. And, of course, it's disenfranchising people who are Hispanic. Also, we already had a system to clean voter rolls. It was called ERIC, the Electronic Registration Information Center, that was a cooperative of many, many states that all partook in it and shared information to do things like ensure that people were not registered in multiple states. After the 2020 election,